Chapter 5. Nicky. Of the delectable conversation which passed between Motley Crue and the entertainment magnates whose good graces are essential to the well-being of our heroes. We fired everybody. Chuck Shapiro, the accountant who had stood by us for nearly 15 years, goodbye. Bob Rock, the producer responsible for our biggest hit and our biggest flop, so long. Doug Thaler, the manager who had been with us ever since we were L.A. fuck-ups pissing in cop cars, see ya. We blamed and fired everybody around us for our failure on the Karabi tour. It was the first time we failed, so hey, it couldn't have been our fault. They were probably glad to get away from us by that point anyway, because we were the worst kind of band in the world, one that is on its way down and refuses to see it or stop it. As we were deciding which of 100 different directions to take our next album in, we hired a new manager named Alan Kovac because, frankly, we were impressed by his ruthlessness. He had brought Duran Duran back from the New Wave grave and had not only gotten Meatloaf his royalties back from Epic Records, but had also given him another hit. We told him that Motley Crue was a band with John Karabi as its singer and that we hoped he wasn't working with us under any other assumption. Of course, he promised, but in my heart I knew that the only reason he had agreed to manage us was so that he could get Karabi out of the band and bring Vince back. A few weeks later, Doug Morris, the CEO of Warner Music, which owned Elektra, called us to New York for a meeting. After all the millions of dollars we had generated for his company, this was the first time they had ever treated us with respect. On the day of the meeting, limos arrived at each of our houses and took us to a private airport, where the Warner's corporate G4 jet, which we'd never even been on before, was waiting for us on the runway. They hadn't invited Karabi to the meeting, but we figured it was just an oversight and brought him along instead of Mick, who wanted to stay home and watch Three Stooges reruns. Karabi and I boarded the plane and found Alan Kovac, his secretary, Tommy, and Pamela Anderson, who Tommy had just married in a whirlwind romance that had caught us all off guard. She was behaving strangely and refused to sit down. Instead, she lay on her back the whole time, mumbling incoherently and rolling around as if she were ill. While she did that, Tommy and I looked at downloads of bestiality pictures on our computers and tried to gross out Kovac's secretary. To us, everything seemed just great. Here we were with a new manager being fed shrimp cocktails and champagne on a corporate jet that was bringing us to a label that gave us $4.5 million every time we nodded our heads to do another record. We figured that Doug Morris wanted to give us some encouragement and say how proud he was of us for sticking to our guns despite a bungled tour and shakeups at the label. It seemed like finally our career was moving up again. We couldn't have been any stupider. The first thing that happened when we arrived at Warner's was that they wouldn't let Karabi up to Morris's office. They made him wait outside in the lobby with Kovac's secretary. The office probably cost as much as my home. It was covered with teak wood and fine art, and there was a piano from the 1800s sitting polished and proud in the corner. Morris sat in a plush velvet couch in front of a teak wood table, smoking a cigar that cost who knows how many hundreds of dollars. We walked in and sat across from him. There were four chairs set up for us, one for Tommy, one for me, one for Kovac, and one empty one. Morris was a very smart and subtle man. He leaned back into the velvet, looking very bald, round, and rich, then dropped his weight forward and fixed us with his eyes. "So," he began, exhaling a cloud of poisonous cigar gas, "we were thinking about what we should do." He paused and looked at the end of his cigar, as if debating whether to relight it or not. We sat there, unsure if we had just been asked a question we were supposed to respond to. Then he continued, "And what we should do is get rid of the guy who's not a star." He then went on to tell us about all the times he had given bands in our same situation ideas that had turned into hits. "I'll tell you what. Call the old guy. Bring him back. Everyone will love that. We'll put out a live record and get you guys on the road. Afterward, we'll set you up for a new studio album." He didn't even have the decency to mention John or Vince by their names. When we disagreed and tried to explain all the reasons why Vince was holding us back and how Karabi was much more in step with what was going on in rock music now, he cut us off. "We are done with this," he said curtly. "This is bullshit." I was about to lose it. I stood up and was beginning my usual "fuck you, we don't need you" rant when Morris's receptionist announced that Sylvia Roan was outside. Roan had taken Bob Krasnow's place as head of Elektra Records. She was the highest-ranking female in the record business and, from what we could tell, did not necessarily comprehend the deep philosophical and humanistic implications of songs like "Girls, Girls, Girls." But, to our surprise, she stuck up for us. "They don't need Vince, Doug," she said. "They are great just as they are. They are very current with John. John is very current." "Yeah, yeah," we all began to chime in. "John has a more organic voice. What we did in the 80s was the 80s, but this is the 90s. It's a different time." "Absolutely," Roan parroted. "It's a different time." Morris stubbed out his cigar and looked at Sylvia. "Do you really think so?" "Absolutely," she said, even more convincingly. "Well then," he said, "I agree with Sylvia." I looked at Kovac excitedly. A meeting that had begun as a disaster was turning into a triumph, but Kovac didn't share my enthusiasm. His face looked clouded and concerned, a semaphore flashing a warning back at me. "I smell a rat." When we left the meeting, Kovac and I followed Sylvia down the hall and cornered her. "Do you really believe this?" Kovac asked her. "Because if you put out this next Motley record, you know that our contract obligates you to put a lot of label resources into promoting and marketing it. I think you know exactly how much money it's going to require, so I want to make sure this is serious." Roan kept nodding her head, saying, "Yeah, baby, yeah, yeah, absolutely, we'll do it." It didn't sound very convincing, especially when she kept looking at her watch. Finally, she cut him off. "Don't worry, it's in good hands," she said. "Now I have to go. I'm late for a meeting." "Okay," Kovac said, and we turned around, walked down the hall toward the exit, looked at each other, and both spoke the same words at the same time. "We're fucked." In the lobby, Karabi was hunched in his chair, wringing his hands and practically dripping with sweat. I smiled weakly at him and said, "You're in." He grinned weakly back, and we all walked outside and grabbed a cab. Kovac took the front seat and turned back to Karabi angrily. "You are not a star," he told him. "And we are in fucking hell. You've got to get it together. The rest of you guys have got to make the greatest album of your entire lives right now, because if you don't, we are dead in the water. There is no way that woman is going to promote this record. We are a tax write-off, a loss. I can smell it. She set us up." Doug Morris had reached out a hand to save us from drowning, and Sylvia Roan had walked right in, kicked his hand away, and sent us tumbling back into the depths. In the weeks that followed, we kept asking her for money to start the new record. She'd give us a little, and we'd start recording. But the money would suddenly dry up, and we'd have to stop. It seemed like she was trying to squeeze and demoralize us, probably because she had inherited a contract from her predecessor that required her to pay huge sums to a band that, as far as she was concerned, was washed up. If we broke up, then our contract was void and the money could be redirected toward the singers and bands she supported. What came next was the sound of a lot of pride being swallowed. Fat from the success of Dr. Feelgood, and with prodding from my wife Brandy, whose materialism seemed to increase in direct proportion to the waning of our love, I had bought a full-on drug dealer mansion. My overhead expenses were $40,000 a month. That's how much it costs just to wake up and go to sleep every day between my house payments and utilities bills. It cost $2,500 in electricity just to cool the house each month, plus I'd insist on keeping my pool heated to 95 degrees year-round. When Tommy and I found ourselves paying for the album out of our own pockets, Mick was long since broke, thanks to Emmy, those things started to matter. At the same time, my third child was being born. Every time Brandy and I came close to separating, another child would pop out to keep us together. And Vince and Charisse's only daughter, Skylar, was dying. I suddenly became aware that everything in life didn't always turn out okay. Life was full of traps, and my future, my happiness, and Motley Crue were all caught fast in them. Tommy and I decided to co-produce the album at his house with a guy named Scott Humphrey, who had done some engineering work with Bob Rock on Feel Good. What we needed was someone to tell us we were fooling ourselves trying to make some sort of electro-grunge record with Corabi. But that someone wasn't Scott Humphrey. An engineer very skilled at a computer studio program called Pro Tools, Humphrey had never produced a band before. He would sit me down and say, "You wrote all the great Motley Crue songs. I don't want Tommy writing songs. He thinks he can write, but all he does is listen to whoever is in that week and copy them. His lyrics have nothing to do with what Motley Crue is all about." Then Scott would pull Tommy aside and whisper in his ear, "Nicky is outdated. He's still stuck in the 80s. You need to be doing the songwriting. You need to be using drum loops and techno beats and bringing the music up to date. You know what's going on." He was completely incapable of dealing with these two giant egos that were Tommy and me. Whoever was in the room, that's whose ass he'd kiss. Except for Mick, who had no ego. Scott started convincing us that Mick was a bad guitarist. When Mick would leave, Scott would pull me aside and make me play something on guitar. Then he'd make a loop of it, put it through some noise filters, and replace Mick's playing. So for the first time in our careers, we started to turn against Mick, to think that he was actually the one holding us back because he thought that the blues and classic rock were the only genres of music that mattered. Pretty soon, Motley Crue was a wildly schizophrenic beast, making some monstrosity that sounded like the Beatles mixed with all these fifth and third Alice in Chains harmonies. We had no idea what we were doing. I guess that's why we decided to call the album, our ninth, Personality Number 9. Though the Gonzo writer Hunter S. Thompson later inspired us to change it to Generation Swine. Eventually, we moved into my drug dealer mansion. We set up the drums in my oak-walled office, the mixing desk in the bathroom, and the Marshall stacks along the marble hallways, while my three children terrorized us and Brandy screamed at me with the regularity of an alarm clock with a snooze button. I'd keep turning her off, but 10 minutes later she'd be blaring in my ear again. In the meantime, Tommy and I continued to work in two completely separate directions. Mick was being brainwashed into believing that he had nothing to contribute to the band, and Corabi was being treated like a criminal who had stolen our careers. Every day, we'd take all our frustrations out on him. We'd tell him that he needed to cut his hair or that he needed to sing in a completely different style. And every week we'd change our minds about everything. We were trying too hard to make a great album, but we had no idea what great was supposed to be anymore because we were too scared to be ourselves. Finally, one day, Corabi told us that he'd had enough. "I'm not a singer," he complained. "I'm a guitar player. I can't do this anymore." So now we had two guitar players and no singer. We were completely turned around. And that's when Kovac, lurking quietly in the background, sprang on us.